Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We keep hearing that the Iraq war is over. Well, maybe for you.
Iraq will be tested in the days ahead by terrorism, by those who would seek to divide, by economic and social issues, by the demands of democracy itself. Challenges remain, but the United States will be there to stand by the Iraqi people.
As Defense Secretary Panetta acknowledged there in his goodbye speech in Iraq, the war is over for Americans, but not for Iraqis. So let's begin the week where last week left off, talking about what maybe we should call the post-American phase of the Iraq war, now 4 days old. Liz Sky is the Baghdad bureau chief for The Washington Post. Liz, welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York. We've heard so much about the feelings of Americans as the last of our troops were pulling out. How are the Iraqis feeling about this?
Well, most Iraqis kind of feel a sense of, real relief about it. Certainly last week, everybody we talked to with three Americans were feeling with a sense of kind of that this was the right thing to do, that they were fed up with having them in their country, and it really had gone on long enough. But in the past few days, we have seen a bit of a political crisis in Latvia, and some Iraqis are starting to feel that...
Liz, let me jump in, because our line is so bad that I think people aren't being able to understand anything that you're saying. We have an additional guest who's also going to join us now. He is Sinan Antoon, an Iraqi-born poet, novelist, now a professor at NYU's Gallatin Division, specializing in contemporary Arab culture and politics. Professor Antoon, welcome back to WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
And we're also on with Liz Sly, the Baghdad bureau chief of The Washington Post. I was just asking Liz, as a journalist, what she sees the mood as being around Iraq, and I realize there are different populations in Iraq. For yourself, first of all, as an Iraqi-born human being who left that country in 1991, what's your feeling as you see American troops leave and as the U.S. media keeps saying the war is over, the war is over?
It's not really going to affect Iraqis as much because the U.S. leaves a legacy behind and leaves the largest embassy it has on the planet, but most importantly, it leaves the political system that it itself created, a political system that is dysfunctional. And I was always against Saddam Hussein, like many people were, but most Iraqis now are pointing to the fact that, as horrible as it may sound, life was better before the United States occupation. Now, that does not mean that one wants Saddam Hussein to return, but the reality is there was a state in Iraq that was functioning and delivering services. Yes, it was a dictatorship. There were no political or social freedoms, but there was a state that was functioning. And after 9 years of U.S. occupation, we do not have a functioning state, and we have an ethno-sectarian system. We've had a civil war. We have terrorism. We have suicide bombings, none of which we had before 2003. So the Iraqis have really a horrible future ahead of them because they have a sectarian government that does not really represent large segments of Iraqi society. They have a state and a government that's really weak regionally, and Iraq has become a playground, frankly, for confrontations between Iran and the U.S. on the one hand, and I might say the U.S. and its ally, Saudi Arabia. So as an Iraqi, I feel, as an Iraqi-American, I feel that here in the U.S., there hasn't been even an apology or any sense of accountability. And what really bothers me most, and bothers a lot of other Americans, is that the architects of this crime, and there is no other word for it, are going around, you know, on TV shows and in mainstream media, whether it's Rumsfeld or Cheney or Condoleezza Rice, and there is no accountability and there is no reckoning for what these politicians did to U.S. citizens and to our taxpayer money, but also to Iraqis. Baghdad now is in the top five most polluted cities in the world. Iraq has the largest refugee population in the entire world. 6% of Iraqis are refugees, either outside of Iraq or internally displaced.
That's like 1.5 million, right?
Yes. So it's like it's almost like 20 million Americans are refugees. So imagine. And electricity levels in Baghdad are still not back to pre-war levels. So imagine what kind of life people have when they have an average of 5 hours of electricity every day. There is not really, I mean, I'm always asked by Americans, is there anything that's good that we, quote-unquote, did over there? And there isn't. But that question in itself says something about this expectation of, you know, somehow our military adventures abroad are supposed to make life better for Iraqis anyone else.
Can we say that one good thing is that Saddam Hussein was overthrown and a transition to democracy has actually begun so that more Iraqis at least have some kind of self-determination today?
No, because overthrowing Saddam Hussein was not the goal of the war, if we remember. You know, the goals of the war shifted three times. And the argument at the time that's the only way to bring democracy to Middle East countries is by military intervention. And I think the revolts in the Arab world in the last year have proven that it's the people themselves organically will change regimes. And let us remember that in 1991, Iraqis rose up. But back then, there was no Al Jazeera, there were no satellite channels. Iraqis rose up in 16 of 18 provinces, and I was living there. But no one supported us, and Saddam Hussein quelled that uprising. But let's remember that the goal of this war was supposedly to remove weapons of mass destruction. It was not to remove Saddam Hussein, because the United States is not in the business of removing dictators. On the contrary, you know, the United States has always been in the business of supporting dictators, especially in the Middle East. Evidence clinging to Mubarak until the last minute, and evidence that our strongest ally in the region is Saudi Arabia, which is not a democracy the last time I checked.
Any other Iraqi Americans listening right now want to weigh in on Iraq going forward now? So much talking about the Americans who are coming home, the veterans, as there should be, but so little talk in the U.S. media about Iraq after the United States. Give us a call if you're an Iraqi American especially, or anybody who wants to talk about what happens next in Iraq, as we are with Sinan Antoun, the Iraqi-born poet, novelist, professor at NYU, and it's 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post your comment or question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. Sinan, how much of a war are we leaving behind in Iraq in terms of an ongoing, active, an IED could explode in your face any minute kind of war?
Well, as I said again, the problem is you don't have really a functioning state. You have a government that's actually kind of a militia culture. And, you know, the major problems that Iraqis have is safety. There is no safety. There are terrorist attacks all the time, as there have been since the arrival of U.S. troops. But that's really not going to be affected for Iraqis by the departure of U.S. troops. We always hear that, and even on the part of some Iraqi politicians, that, oh, what will happen to Iraqis now that the U.S. troops are leaving? But let's remember that at the height of the civil war, the U.S. was there and it didn't do anything to prevent that. The problem is that we have militias that have been integrated into the government itself and into the parties. And we have rampant, the ownership of weapons is really high. So we have a militarized sectarian society with a state that has not been able to monopolize. I mean, that's what states do. They monopolize violence, and then you have a functioning non-sectarian police force. And we do not have that. So for Iraqis, the threat is always there, and the other threat is the rampant crime and gangs and kidnapping and all sorts of criminal activities. Once again, that were not as rampant before 2003.
How trained is the Iraqi military to deal with this? There has been, you know, so much discussion in this country about whether the Iraqi police and military are ready for the U.S. withdrawal. That was supposed to be the end point of the U.S. involvement when they were ready. How ready are they?
I'm not sure that they're that ready, but this begs the question of what was the U.S. doing for 8 years? I mean, if after 8 years the army and the police are not ready, what was happening? You know, we don't have time to go through it, but I'm sure your listeners know about it. There's been so much corruption in the so-called reconstruction program, and so many corrupt police officers from here sent over there. But if after 8 years the Iraqi army is not ready and the police is not ready, then that really says something about what it is that the U.S. was doing for 8 years. You know, the only thing that was functioning very well and still functioning well is the oil sector. And I just saw today images of the U.S. embassy that was built in Baghdad, and that seems to be perfect and functioning very well. It's amazing. People should go to the Reuters website and look at that. But everything outside of that is not really functioning. And once again, in order to comprehend the damage, we have to realize that there was a police force in Iraq in 2003, and there was an army. And one of the not mistakes but crimes against the Iraqis is to disband the Iraqi army and disband the police and not really rebuild something that is functioning. I mean, now it's ridiculous because Iraq, for example, what kind of sovereign state that cannot protect its skies and cannot protect its borders and cannot protect its waters? You know, Turkey is doing all kinds of things with the water sources, and so is Iran. Kuwait is building a gigantic port that actually infringes upon Iraqi territory and international and Iraq's waters, but the government cannot do anything. Now there are negotiations for the government to buy some F-16s and so on and so forth. Only now, after 8 years. But let's remember also that there is a huge U.S. base in the north in Kurdistan, and U.S. troops are actually in Kuwait. So if need be, U.S. forces will go back again. And most importantly, what's been missing from most of the narrative is that, you know, the U.S. is only withdrawing because Obama could not convince Maliki to extend the agreement and keep troops there for longer. The disagreement was over the jurisdiction under which these contractors, will they be subject to Iraqi law or U.S. law? So had Maliki agreed to the conditions, there would not have been a total withdrawal.
I think that's a very underreported point and a true point that, as I understand it, the expiration at the end of this year of an exemption for Americans over there from being prosecuted for whatever they may be accused of or certain things that they may be accused of under Iraqi law as opposed to American law, that seemed to hasten the U.S.'s
yes.
retreat. So
exactly.
That's one of the things that's kind of getting lost in the shuffle. Let's try Liz Sly again in Baghdad, the Washington Post bureau chief there. See if we have any better of a phone connection right now. Liz, can you hear me?
I can, yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, it's a little bit better. You wrote an article the other day headlined Iraq's Shiites in No Mood to Embrace Iran. And this, of course, relates to one of the things that Americans are concerned about with respect to a withdrawal. Iraq and Iran used to be enemies when Iraq was run by Saddam Hussein, much to the delight of the United States because they liked those two fighting with each other. But Iraq is a Shiite majority country. Saddam Hussein was a Sunni. And Iran is a Shiite majority country, and there's been a lot of fear that Iraq would come under Iranian influence, both for the identification of the populations with each other and just because of the military and political strength of the Iranian government. But you wrote an article headlined, Iraq's Shiites in No Mood to Embrace Iran. What were you trying to tell us?
Well, basically that it's an extremely complicated situation, but not as simplistic as has been made out in America. I think U.S. concerns that Iraq will fall under Iranian influence are very justified, because Iran does have a lot of very close ties with some of the politicians here, and almost certainly it's penetrated intelligence, the security forces, and has agents and people like that who will be able to work on its behalf and do its bidding into the future. But that is not going to stop you with Iraqi people, not with the Sunnis and not with the Shiites either. Of course, Shiites in Iran and Shiites in Iraq share the same religion, as you point out, but they are ethnically different. They are Persians and they are Arabs, and Arabs and Persians have been rivals for years. And any Iraqi politician who tries to get too close to Iran isn't going to be very popular.
Let's take a phone call. Joseph in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joseph. Yeah. Thanks for calling
in. And I'm Iraqi too, and I'm really shaken and upset by the words of the professor said. The few academic statements that he came with or statistic ignore what happened in Iraq before U.S. came in. There was a suspicious of nuclear, weapon of mass destruction. We know the hundreds of thousands of code that Saddam Hussein blew, and we know the nuclear facility he built and was destroyed by Israel, and so there was something there. But the United States went in there. Few thousands of American soldiers die over there. We know that we saved the Iraqis as a nation by being tortured by Saddam Hussein. And yes, there was a few mistakes over there, but for that to say, to stay in United States and condemn United States for setting free Iraq, I think it's very wrong.
Professor Antoun?
You know, when I was living in Iraq in the 80s and Saddam Hussein was torturing the population, I remember very well watching the news and hearing President Reagan sending telegrams of congratulations to Saddam Hussein. And I remember seeing Donald Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein. So at least we have to agree that the United States is not in the business of saving populations who are being tortured. There were no chemical weapons. There were no nuclear weapons. Yes, Israel destroyed the nuclear Iraqi reactor in violation of international law, but that's something else. Thousands of U.S. soldiers died in Iraq, but conservative estimates tell us that at least 160,000 Iraqis died. There are 1 million widows. There are. Excuse me, sir.
Go ahead, Professor. Go ahead.
There are 3 million orphans in Iraq. I am a U.S. citizen. I'm doing my duty by critiquing the government, which has lied to us about Iraq and about so many other things. It's not up to you or me. It's up to us to listen to what Iraqis inside are saying about the effects of the war on them.
Joseph, I'll give you the last word. What about the theory that Saddam Hussein was basically neutralized by the time this war began in 2003? He couldn't have undertaken another slaughter of the Kurds or anyone in his own country because the West had such an eye on him. And if things had just been allowed to remain without the U.S. invasion, then he would have been toppled by the Arab Spring too, with much less cost to Iraqi civilians.
I will answer for that. If this professor is so care of his nation, why didn't he go there before and try to organize a demonstration like in Egypt? Arab Spring is here. His people are not ready for this, or they are still scared of the new government, or something happened over there for millions of Iraqi to sit silent and being tortured again by bombs and by all kind of things that between them, the religious and whatever is there. They are not ready. And I think, and you don't know if Saddam Hussein would be quiet after what. He might get more power and slaughter more people. They are digging the ground. Wherever they dig, they found bodies of innocent Iraqis.
Joseph, I'm going to leave it there, and we are out of time, so I want to thank you for your call. I want to thank Liz Sly, Washington Post Baghdad Bureau Chief, and thanks Sinan Antoun, Iraqi-born poet, novelist, and professor at NYU. Thank you all very much. Brian Lehrer in WNYC, and coming up next, New York Times columnist Joe Nocera on the two CEOs from Fannie and Freddie who have been accused of wrongdoing. What business Mitt Romney's business is actually in? How do they make money at Bain Capital Management? Stay with us.